Chapter 5. Insight and Purification. I sometimes have the honor of helping one of my meditation students go through the dying process. One of these was a colorful character named Gino, who kind of looked like Popeye the Sailor Man. Gino had been a sea captain and had been torpedoed in World War II. In fact, his ship was blown out from under him twice, and he survived. He was a really tough character, the sort of guy that could get into a dock fight with four other guys and be the last man standing. This extraordinary individual introduced himself to me by saying that he was getting kicked out of the nearby Zen center where he lived. He'd gotten pissed off at the head monk and cold-cocked him. Quite an introduction. He was wondering if he could come live at our meditation center. I don't know why we let him in, but we did. He turned out to be a very devoted practitioner, who meditated with me for about 5 or 6 years, and eventually became quite skillful. Years later, he was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. It was time to die, and he knew it, and he wanted to do it well. He had moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, so I went out there for a while to help him through his dying process. However, it took longer than we had expected, and unfortunately, I couldn't stay on to guide him all the way to the end. As I was leaving, he asked me for some final advice on how to optimize his experience of dying. I told him that as far as I could see, he was facing 5 distinct types of challenging body sensations. First, there was the pain of the tumor. Then there was the sensation of exhaustion, because he couldn't sleep very well. Third, there was nausea, which is another distinct quality of sensation. Finally, on the emotional side, there was some irritability and also some fear present. Gino agreed. These 5 body sensations were exactly what he was feeling. I told him that his job was straightforward. Never lose track of these 5 qualities of sensation. Whichever one or combination of them was arising, be precise about where they are in the body. Note where the primary location is and whether it spreads out through the body. Keep infusing each one of these qualities with concentration, clarity, and equanimity. Allow them to get intense or mild, to shift and spread, to expand out and contract in, whatever way they wish. I told him this would reduce his perceived suffering and make dying a good process rather than a horrific one. He had enough background in meditation to understand the instructions and to implement them, and indeed the dying process went well for him. His suffering was lessened because he was keeping track of what was going on in a state of concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity, the essence of mindfulness. But more than that, he started to identify each of the different flavors of sensation with the purification of the psychological and spiritual blockages acquired from his previously badass lifestyle. He felt that the various intense sensations were cleaning out specific negative things he had done and the bad ways he had treated other people. For example, when I was talking to him on the phone once, he excused himself, saying he'd be right back. In the distance, I could hear him vomiting into the toilet. Then he came back and described how, during that vomiting jag, he just worked through a big piece of karma relating to his son. As he infused those 5 types of body sensation with concentration, clarity, and equanimity, he could actually feel them reaching down into the memory bank where the guilt and regret were stored and cleaning them out. For him, each sensation was correlated with a specific thing it was purifying. The exhaustion cleaned him out in one way, and the fear cleaned him out in another. As this was happening, he was gaining insights into the meaning of his life, including the nature of various intense conflicts he had had with people. Because of this practice, his dying process became a process of insight and purification, wisdom and catharsis. During the time I was staying with Gino, guiding him through his transition, I got a call from a former student, Ben. Before taking early retirement, Ben had been in the entertainment industry as a producer, writer, and comedy performer. His unexpected call led to one of the most moving scenes I had ever witnessed. Ben was totally freaking out. Earlier that morning, doctors had discovered an enormous tumor in his abdomen, and there was a very real possibility that it might take his life. Ben was relatively young, and this turn of events was totally unexpected. In panic and desperation, he was calling me for support. I reviewed for him the principles and practices I'd taught him, reminded him of how to deconstruct fear by breaking it into mental image, mental talk, and body emotion. I also reminded him that a final diagnosis had not been made yet. But my attempts at comforting him were not very successful. I sensed he was on the verge of losing it. Then it hit me. Why not have Ben talk to Gino? Gino, who at that moment was going through the process that Ben might be facing in 6 months or so. I went to Gino's room and explained the situation and handed him the phone. In the intervals between coughing, vomiting, and convulsing, Gino gently assured Ben that there was nothing to fear in the dying process. It's just a return to a simpler, more primordial mode of being. And he described how the sensations he was currently experiencing had become for him a process of spiritual cleansing and empowerment. The power of Gino's words was palpable. This was not a theoretical discussion. He was speaking about dying from the place of dying. It was an incredibly moving scene. The former badass sea captain, from his bed of agony, comforting the freaked-out Hollywood actor. The interaction helped Ben calm down enough to start untangling the fear with a focusing technique. Although waiting for the biopsy was still tough for Ben, it was less hellish than it would have been otherwise. Contrary to expectations, Ben's tumor turned out to be benign. Often, meditation works this way. We measure its value in terms of the suffering that would have happened but didn't, thanks to the fact that we have a practice. As you can see from this story, when we apply concentration, clarity, and equanimity to sensory experience, moment by moment, we generate a process of insight and purification. Over time, this improves our lives, the lives of those around us, and the world in general. It can make dying bearable, even meaningful. Breaking things down. A common strategy in the sciences is to take a complex phenomenon and break it down into its natural components. Analysis of these components allows us to understand the complex phenomenon at a deeper level, to have some control over it, and to predict things about it. The field of chemistry gives us a good example of this. The set of known substances in the world is enormous, and their structure is often quite complex. There's everything from monosodium glutamate to clouds, to gasoline, to sugar crystals, to biological macromolecules. But scientists are able to explain this vast diversity in terms of roughly 100 basic elements. That's because they came up with an elegant classification, the periodic table of chemical elements. This allowed them to distinguish the basic building blocks. This in turn revealed that a relatively small set of elements can explain the enormously diverse range of substances and chemical properties. This basic strategy of analyzing complex phenomena into simpler elements is part of the secret sauce that makes science so powerful. One very complex phenomenon that is of central importance for all human beings is our sensory experience. Human experience is quite complex. Just think of everything that has ever happened to you since the day you were born. Fortunately, there is a natural way to break down any experience into much simpler components. When we look at an experience in terms of these simpler components, it's much easier to understand, to manage, and to gain insight. This sort of analysis is the secret sauce of mindfulness meditation.
When you think about it, all of human experience can be understood as sensory experience. That is, we only know about self and world through our senses.
Recall that thought is sensory, mental image and mental talk, and emotions are sensory, mental image, mental talk, plus emotional body sensations. So following the example of chemistry, let's create a periodic table of sensory elements, a way to classify sensory events in terms of basic elements. In the West, we tend to think that there are 5 senses, but in Buddhist theory, there are 6. The 6 senses in Buddhist theory are hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and the thinking mind. Personally, I like to slice up the pie of sensory experience slightly differently. I separate body experience into physical-type body sensations and emotional-type body sensations. For simplicity, I include the chemical senses, smell and taste, into the category of physical-type body sensations. I separate mental experience into a visual component, mental images, and an auditory component, mental talk. This creates a nice symmetrical system, the core subjective self, thoughts, emotions, will, conviction, confusion, judgment, reaction, memory, problem-solving, fantasy. all arise through the inner activity of mental images, mental talk, and emotional body sensations. The perception that there's a physical world around us arises through outer activity. Physical sights, physical sounds, and physical body sensations. Let's look briefly at the nuts and bolts of this formulation. Thinking mind. The thinking mind is quite a complex phenomenon. Human thoughts created relativity theory, Gödel's incompleteness theorems, Shakespeare's plays, Hegel's philosophy, and Hitler's ideology. What system of analysis will allow us to break down something as complicated as all thinking into relatively simple constituents? If you look very carefully, you will see that most of the thoughts that we are consciously aware of come either as internal conversations, mental talk, or internal imagery, mental images, or a combination of the two. In terms of mental talk, we find that we think in words, phrases, sentences, and narratives. If you're multilingual, your mental talk will be in more than one language. But it is still grammatical human speech. Sometimes we hear our own voice, and sometimes other people's voices. Sometimes it's a dialogue, sometimes it's a monologue. What I call mental talk can also take the form of nonverbal tunes, or music, or internal onomatopoeia. The other mode of the thinking process is imaging. We see things in the mind's eye, such as vague forms, scenes, faces, situations, or spatial relationships. Mental images are like the things that we see in the external world, but usually are not vivid or stable like physical objects or photographs. For most people, mental images are nebulous, semi-transparent, half-formed, and fleeting. However, for a minority of people, mental images are vivid and stable. Such people are said to possess eidetic imagery. Artists often possess eidetic imagery. Some people think mainly in the internal auditory mode. Some think more in the internal visual mode. And for most of us, both are present. This is how thought appears to us generally, in inner words and mental pictures. Thus, we can easily deconstruct the thinking process. The myriad of complex meanings is simplified into a tetrad of basic states. Mental image without any accompanying mental talk. Mental talk without any accompanying mental image. Image and talk at the same time. Or absence of both image and talk. A moment of total mental tranquility. This tetrad represents a great reduction in complexity and gives us a powerful handle on thought because it allows us to keep track of what's going on in the mind in real time and in a tangible way. But isn't there more to thought than surface images and mental words? What about subconscious thought? It turns out that the visual versus auditory analysis works out beautifully well for that too. Visual thought takes place in certain locations. For many people, images associated with memory, planning, and fantasy tend to occur in front of, behind, the eyes. Self-images tend to occur where the body is, and when your eyes are closed, the images you get of your surroundings tend to be arrayed out and around you. Also, for most people, mental talk tends to occur in the head or at the ears. The locations where images might occur could be referred to as image space, and the locations where talk might occur could be referred to as talk space. Mind space would then be the union of those two spaces. Notice that this formulation not only makes mental experience qualitatively tangible, visual experience versus auditory experience, but it also makes it spatially tangible. Mental images and mental talk occur in specific locations and have width, depth, and height. We can think of image activity and talk activity as the independent components of a thought vector. Thought now becomes a tangible, time-varying vector field. The magnitude of that vector represents the overall intensity of thought, and its direction represents the relative contributions of visual versus auditory qualities. For most people, image space tends to center in front of, behind their eyes, an area sometimes referred to as one's mental screen. Talk space tends to be somewhat posterior, in the head and/or at the ears. Viewed this way, your mind sort of has a front side and a back side, just like your body does. The clarity aspect of mindfulness practice has several facets. One facet of clarity is discrimination skill, the ability to separate. Another aspect of clarity is detection skill, the ability to pick up on what's subtle. A natural place to begin observing the mind is by discriminating image versus talk. At some point, surface pictures and explicit words tend to die away. At that point, you begin to detect a subtle undercurrent, a sort of subterranean stirring in image space and talk space. That's your subconscious mind. You don't see explicit images or hear explicit words, but you know which part is visual and which part is auditory by its location. Unblocking the natural flow of this subtle mental activity nurtures intuition, wisdom, and creativity. But you can't unblock it until you can detect it. Parsing thought into image and talk opens the door for that possibility. The ability to keep track of the distinct components of our experience is incredibly useful. First, you learn to separate experience into a few basic components. This sets the stage for detecting and untangling the subcomponents of those components, and then the sub-subcomponents, until we can get down into the ultimate building blocks or substance that underlies all experience. This makes experience trackable. The basic mantra of mindfulness is simple. Trackable implies tractable. The feeling body. Turning from the mind to the body, we see a similar potential. Embodied experience is a very complex phenomenon, but we can break it down into two main constituents: physical-type body sensation and emotional-type body sensation. Physical-type body sensation requires no special explanation. A pain in your knee, the feeling of your muscles working, the sensation of cold, and an itch on your scalp are all physical-type body sensations. The notion of emotional-type body sensation is, at first, an unusual concept for some people. As a culture, we don't often talk about emotions as something that occurs in the body. We tend to think of them as mental, cognitive events. However, if we have a very strong emotion, it's quite easy to contact the body sensations associated with it. Those body sensations are the primitive juice of the emotion. So these are the two basic qualitative categories of body sensations: physical and emotional. These two big components of body sensation can be broken down much further into sub-subdimensions. For both physical-type body sensations and emotional-type body sensations, we can distinguish sub-qualities of the feeling. Hot feels different from cold. Pressure feels different from an itch. Embarrassment feels different from anger. Anger feels different from fear. Fear feels different from sadness. Sadness feels different from a burn. A burn feels different from a cut. And they all feel different from the touch of your clothes, or the sensation of the blood circulating, or the feeling of the breathing process, or tiredness, or being very alert and energetic. Tiredness has a quality of body sensation associated with it, as do sleepiness, boredom, and impatience. Doubt, indecision, and confusion are things that occur in the mind, but they often also have associated body sensations. There are many flavors or qualities of body sensation. However, these flavors are not infinite. I suppose perceptual psychologists could get into long discussions about exactly how many fundamental sensation types there are, but I would say, based on my own experience, that there can't be more than a couple of dozen really distinct ones. If we limit our consideration to just emotional-type body sensations, the most common flavors are anger, fear, sadness, embarrassment, impatience, disgust, interest, joy, love, gratitude, humor, and smile. If you want to be happy independent of conditions, you'll need to learn how to have a complete experience of each basic type of body sensation. On the spiritual path, we have to learn how to have a complete experience of anger, so that anger does not cause suffering, which then distorts our behavior. For the same reason, we have to learn how to have a complete experience of fear, sadness, and so on. We even have to learn to have a complete experience of physical pain, as well as other unpleasant feelings in the body, such as fatigue and nausea. When I say, have a complete experience of X, it's just a quick way of saying, experience X with so much concentration, clarity, and equanimity that there's no time to coagulate X, or yourself, into a thing. You and X become an integrated flow of energy and spaciousness. Learning how to have a complete experience of discomfort sets us free. Learning how to have a complete experience of pleasure deeply fulfills. For example, Erotic sexual sensation is a major pleasant quality. In India, Tibet, and China, there's a whole tradition of transmuting sexual experience into spiritual energy. In the West, this endeavor is sometimes referred to as tantric practice, but scholars are quick to point out that using the Sanskrit word tantra as a synonym for sexual is historically misleading and inaccurate. Putting aside the controversy over the name and ignoring New Age hype, the spiritualizing of your amatory life is really quite simple and straightforward. The body sensations of making love are spiritual to the extent that they are complete, that is, experienced in a state of concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity. To know what true love is, we need to experience it as it truly is. In Tibet, that's called the oneness of bliss and void. In addition to quality of the body sensations, the basic types, there's the issue of intensity. Intensity represents a dimension of body experience that's independent from quality, type. Anything from a mild irritation to a homicidal rage is really part of one family, the anger family. Both have the same basic quality or flavor, but present at a different intensity level. Rage is just a higher intensity version of irritation. Likewise, anything from slightly uncomfortable anticipation to paralytic terror is an example of the fear flavor. Intensity, then, is another way that we can categorize or track our body sensations while meditating. Clarity gives us the ability to detect sensory events that are subtle or not very intense. This, combined with equanimity, allows us to have a high degree of fulfillment on demand during the day. So subtle pleasures can be very significant. On the other hand, subtle discomforts can also be very significant. If the spread of a subtle discomfort is not detected and equanimized, it might coagulate into enormous perceived suffering. Thus, the combination of clarity and equanimity applied to subtle experiences is helpful both for elevating fulfillment and reducing suffering. The third dimension of body feeling is its spatial distribution, meaning location and shape of body sensations. Once we understand that body feelings are tangible, then we can start to talk about the location of a feeling, the geometric shape of a feeling, and so forth. We can talk about how a feeling may have its primary location in one part of the body and spread more subtle influences throughout the rest of the body. The way I like to define it, mindful awareness is concentration, clarity, and equanimity working together. Clarity helps us to detect and discriminate qualities, intensities, and spatial patterns in what we see, hear, and feel. It gives us the ability to analyze our sensorium in terms of how much, of what, where, when, interacting in what ways, and changing at what rate. Interestingly, this set of categories corresponds to the most common variables that scientists use for quantifying the natural world. The last variable, changing at what rate, corresponds to what modern scientists call the time derivative of a function. It's one of the main things that you learn about if you take calculus. Many people contributed to the historical development of calculus, but the name most commonly associated with its invention is that of Sir Isaac Newton. Newton, however, used a different word for what we now call the time derivative. He called it the fluxion, which is Latin for mode of flow. Tracking rates of change in sensory experience leads to insight into impermanence, a huge theme in the Buddhist tradition. This makes a nice parallel with science. Buddhist meditators learn to take the derivative of what they see, hear, and feel. How thoughts and feelings intertwine. When we become skilled at tracking the subtleties of our internal sensory landscape, we can encounter our experience in a clearer way. Take, for example, the experience of anger. When you have an experience of anger, you have talk in your head. He said such and such. How dare he do such and such? The next time he does such and such, I'm going to do such and such. But what I would really like to do is such and such. We hear words like these in our mental talk space. Meanwhile, on the internal screen, the mind's eye, there are pictures that go with these words. We might picture ourselves striking back or stalking off. Taken together, these internal words and pictures constitute the thought component of the anger experience. While these are going on, a tight quality is happening in the gut. A shaky quality is arising in the legs and spreading through the rest of the body. A hot quality is moving over the face and also spreading subtly over the rest of the body, and a pressured quality is arising in the chest. These feelings are the emotional type body sensation component of the anger experience. These three components of anger, mental image, mental talk, and emotional body sensations, often occur simultaneously. Without clarity, they become a tangled skein. Without equanimity, that tangled skein coagulates into a solid mass of congealed suffering. And what's true of anger is true of all mind-body experience. If we develop an ability to discern the components of the experience, we can begin to keep track of what part is thought and what part is feeling. But if you don't have the skill of keeping track of the components, then you get this mixture, this tangling together of the feeling body and the thinking mind. And the result of the tangling together can bring about two undesirable consequences. The first, quantitative, the second, qualitative. The first undesirable consequence of tangling is an illusory intensification of the experience. This is a quantitative effect. It makes the suffering associated with an uncomfortable experience seem much worse than it actually is. Without sensory clarity, the different components of the experience don't just add together, they crisscross and mutually multiply. For example, if we have 10 units of discomfort in the body and 10 units of negativity in the mind, what we actually have is 20, 10 plus 10 equals 20, units of undesirable experience. That is what you will experience if you have sensory clarity, just what it is. However, if you don't keep track of what is going on, each of the 10 units of discomfort in the body will interact with each of the 10 units of negativity in the mind, cross-multiplying to produce the illusion of 100, 10 times 10 equals 100, units of undesirable experience. If I have to be uncomfortable, I'd much prefer 20 units to 100. Sensory clarity skills give me that choice. Imagine adding a few more units of undesirable experience, and it's easy to see why we can become so suddenly overwhelmed. For example, if we double the amount of each component, there will be 20 units of discomfort in the body and 20 units of negativity in the mind. Assuming you maintain sensory clarity, the effect is marginal. The distress only rises a little. 20 plus 20 equals 40. However, if we allow the thoughts and feelings to tangle together, they multiply. And we now have the experience of 400, 20 times 20 equals 400, units of distress. Even though in reality we only have 40, 20 plus 20 equals 40. This explains why things can get out of hand so quickly. Such exacerbated suffering will often distort our response to a situation, leading to even more suffering. This is the essence of the vicious cycle that Buddhists refer to as samsara. The second undesirable consequence of tangling is a qualitative effect, and it's a bit conceptually subtle. But it's also very useful to know about. The tangling of three sensory strands, mental image, mental talk, and body sensations, imparts an illusory quality of thingness to the experience of self. If you are able to fully untangle those strands, the illusory quality of thingness goes away. I'll be discussing this in more detail in Chapter 8. The basic model. The basic model for the mindfulness-based spiritual path is to take some type of experience and infuse it with a high degree of concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity. Concentration means to focus attention on just what you deem relevant. Sensory clarity involves discerning the components that constitute an experience and detecting their subtle essence. Equanimity means that we give permission for these components to expand, to contract, or to be still, to do whatever they naturally would do. Equanimity is a radical non-interference with the natural flow of our senses. In other words, we can take any type of experience and attempt to be focused, precise, and allowing with it. Greeting experiences this way, both in formal practice and as we are doing things in day-to-day life, catalyzes a process of insight and purification. In a chemical reaction, the role of the catalyst is to speed up a process that would occur naturally, but perhaps very slowly. The catalyst interacts with the reactants in a way that can dramatically speed things up. Similarly, concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity interact with the experiences of life to speed up a natural process of psychospiritual evolution. Whether they know it or not, All human beings are involved in the path to enlightenment by virtue of living daily life. Nature, or grace, or spirit, if you're comfortable with such words, is constantly pulling us toward the enlightened state. The main difference between a practitioner and any other person is the speed at which they are intentionally moving along this path. To sum up, infusing concentration, clarity, and equanimity into an experience functions like a catalyst facilitating a natural process of insight and purification that is just waiting to happen. Thus, the fundamental theorem of mindfulness is concentration plus sensory clarity plus equanimity plus time equals insight plus purification. Insight. Spiritual insight, prajna, is like a many-faceted jewel. We have already talked about some sides of insight. The insight that physical and emotional pain don't have to turn into suffering. The insight that pleasure will yield deeper satisfaction if we don't tighten around it. The insight into how the sense of a particulate self arises through a tangling together of thought and feeling. An insight into the mechanism of how we can experience merging or uniting with another. The basic premise of mindfulness meditation is that consistently infusing the qualities of concentration, clarity, and equanimity into ordinary experience over time causes a fundamental shift in our paradigm. It is for this reason that mindfulness is sometimes called insight meditation. Purification. Most growth modalities, from 19th century psychoanalysis to 20th century Scientology, and just about everything in between, share a common paradigm. It goes something like this. We store influences from the past in the subconscious. Those influences inappropriately affect our behavior and perception in the present. And our job is to somehow remove those distorting influences. There are many different names for those influences, such as imprints, engrams, complexes, residues, and fixations. In India, and cultures influenced by India, they are referred to as samskaras, which means something like grooves or impressions. Samskara is a Sanskrit word. Yet another Sanskrit word for the same thing is vasana, which means something like habit influence. The notion that we carry subconscious, limiting forces from the past was discovered in India centuries, nay millennia, before Freud and Jung. The samskaras are located in the deep subconscious. We are not aware of them on the surface. But we notice that despite our best intentions to be different, year after year, we seem to be pulled into the same coagulated patterns of perception and action. And despite the fact that we may believe that there is a spiritual reality constantly present, our daily experience is one of separateness, materiality, discomforts, and banality. We don't seem to have a beatific vision every time we turn our head. We don't typically feel each body event as the touch of spirit. So if, as many believe, we really are embedded in spiritual reality, why don't we see it? Why isn't every vision beatific? It's because of those fixating forces deep down in the subconscious. And our job, according to a plethora of self-help paradigms, is to become free from those forces. In the Buddhist, Hindu, and Abrahamic contemplative traditions, the process of becoming free of those limiting forces is sometimes referred to as purification, vishuddhi in Sanskrit, catharsis in Greek. Purification could be described as the process that breaks this material up, digests it, metabolizes it, and, pardon the metaphor, excretes it. Purification is what it tastes like as we are getting free from those limiting grooves. It's a sort of immediate reward. You sense that the limitations of the past are being metabolized and a brighter future is being created because of the way you're experiencing a certain something in the present. Once you learn to taste purification, your growth goes exponential. The ability to taste purification is the sign of a mature spiritual palate. It's what allowed Gino to die well. Just as there are many facets to the insight process, prajna, there are many different ways in which we can talk about the purification process, vishuddhi. If you want to use a theological paradigm, you would say that purification is the working through of our sinfulness, gradually burning away what's lodged between the surface self and the spiritual source of self. For example, a form of meditation is practiced in the Eastern Orthodox Church that is in some ways remarkably similar to mindfulness. It's called nepsis, sober observation. It expresses the idea of purification using the Greek word katharsis, which means cleansing. It is a doctrine of the Eastern Orthodox Church that we can cleanse away enough sinfulness to experience theosis, which means literally becoming like God. According to the Orthodox Church, theosis is the goal of human life. The Christian notion of theosis is clearly distinguished from the pagan notion of apotheosis, which refers to a human being claiming that they are a god. In Christianity, sin is original, but purification is possible through a combination of effort and grace. In Buddhism, purity, sometimes called the Buddha nature, is original, meaning that consciousness is by nature pure. But we are subject to three fundamental impurities, kleshas in Sanskrit. The three impurities are craving, aversion, and unconsciousness, raga, dvesha, moha in Sanskrit. So our pure consciousness gets mucked up, and that leads to suffering. Buddhism sees the samskaras as impurities, not in the sense of uncleanliness or sin, but impurity in the sense of admixture. It's a metallurgical metaphor. Consciousness is by nature like gold, but these three impurities are mixed in the ore. In this paradigm, purification means the removing of that which is foreign to the gold, leaving just the pure gold. Through meditation, we smelt away the kleshas. We refine the ore, and we are left with what always was, the pure gold of pure consciousness. The modern psychoanalytic paradigm of purification says that there are various unpleasant memories, incomplete experiences, and holdings stored in the deep mind, the repressed pool of poison and pain of the Freudian subconscious. From a Buddhist perspective, that old material gets worked through by pouring clarity and equanimity into the experience of the moment. That clarity and equanimity percolate down into the subconscious and give the subconscious what it needs to dissolve its issues. Moreover, unlike many psychological models, in the Buddhist formulation, it is not always necessary to remember specific events or the content of past experiences. The Buddhist paradigm holds that most of the purification comes about because clarity and equanimity seep down into the subconscious, where the subconscious uses them to untie its own knots. Often when we meditate, we are not consciously aware of much happening. It just seems like we are sitting there. Much of the time, our mind may be wandering, and when our mind is not wandering, it goes to sleep. After a while, we become aware that we are physically uncomfortable, and then we come back to our object of meditation for a couple of seconds. Sometimes meditation practice goes on and on like this, and it doesn't seem as if anything of real value is taking place. When we tell our friends what we experienced at a meditation retreat, mostly pain, sleepiness, and confusion, they may well say, "You paid good money for that?" But all the while, clarity and equanimity are slowly but surely trickling down into the subconscious. They rewire us at the most fundamental levels without us necessarily knowing it at the time. How do we know that it's happening? We notice that things are changing in daily life. Our behavior and perception seem to be improving spontaneously. It is almost as though somebody is performing plastic surgery on your soul. You have been under anesthesia, and when you wake up, you look different, and you are not quite sure what happened in between. In meditation, a lot of the learning that takes place is of this type. Meditation can clean out stored materials without necessarily requiring that you recall specific memories, traumas, and such. We might refer to this paradigm as the trickle-down model for reaching the subconscious. This contrasts with the dredge-up model used in much of psychotherapy. In the dredge-up model, we reach down and explore a specific complex. This leads to a specific personal insight that then improves our quality of life. Dredge-up and trickle-down could be looked upon as mutually complementary processes. For some meditators, trickle-down purification may be sufficient. But when that's not the case, they can utilize the services of dredge-up experts, that is, competent mental health professionals. It's important to appreciate the awesome power of meditation practice, but it's also important to realize its limitations. Sometimes other elements are required: therapy, 12-step programs, openness to social feedback, having a list of explicitly stated ethical guidelines, and so forth. Another possible description of the purification process is a somewhat mechanistic paradigm that I'm fond of. In this paradigm, the six senses, what I like to call inner and outer, see, hear, feel, have a kind of viscosity to them, like molasses. We've all heard the expression, flowing like molasses on a cold winter's day, meaning something that flows very slowly. If, however, we warm the molasses up, it becomes incomparably more fluid and flows quickly. Pervading our inner and outer see, hear, feel experience is a kind of subtle internal friction or viscosity that keeps our senses from flowing freely. This microscopic coagulation in the natural flow of the senses creates a kind of internal friction. It causes our visual field to congeal, giving us the impression that space is rigid. It causes our internal conversations to congeal, giving us the impression that thoughts are real. It causes our body sensation to congeal, giving us the impression that the body is material. This microscopic, second-by-second self-interference in the sensory circuits is analogous to microscopic muscle tension.
There are dozens of tiny micro-tensions subliminally present within each inner or outer experience. It is the sensory system working against itself, a sort of micro-self-conflict.
In the mechanistic model of purification, the idea is to remove the microscopic subliminal self-interference within the sensory circuits. This view is congruent with the paradigm of psychotherapy, which also seeks to reduce self-conflict. The difference, however, is that therapy talks about getting rid of macroscopic self-conflicts. Psychological-type purification is very important, but in meditation the emphasis is on dealing with the microscopic self-conflicts. As we infuse clarity and equanimity into our sensory circuits, their internal friction lessens. Inner and outer sense experience goes from jagged ice to flowing water, and from flowing water to vaporous steam. Chemically, ice, liquid water, and steam are the same, but their physical characteristics are quite different. Analogously, frozen see, hear, feel, and fluid see, hear, feel are sensorially the same, but their spiritual characteristics are quite different. I call this the rheological paradigm of purification. Rheology is a branch of engineering that describes nonlinear flow in nature. In the rheological paradigm of purification, the goal is to remove this microscopic, ubiquitous, and invisible coagulation from the substance of consciousness itself. Let's review. We have considered four paradigms for purification: Christian, Buddhist, psychological, and rheological. In the Christian paradigm, the blockage that separates self from source is called sin. Its radical removal is viewed largely as a matter of grace, but personal effort also plays a role. In Buddhism, the impurities are seen as secondary. Their radical removal is viewed as feasible with effort. But it is also true that certain Buddhist traditions emphasize letting go of effort and letting the nature of consciousness itself do the work. This trust in the nature of consciousness is the Buddhist analog of Christian faith and grace. The Buddhist view contrasts with the psychological view in certain ways. Western psychology is often interested in dredging up specific biographical material to aid in repairing specific aspects of personality. In Buddhist practice, clarity and equanimity are poured into the sensory circuits, causing a global transformation throughout the whole of the subconscious. The practitioner may not even be consciously aware of any specific biographical content. One just notices that life is getting easier, behaviors are improving, and the only explanation is that the subconscious must be reorganizing itself due to the infusion of clarity and equanimity. Don't get me wrong, I'm not implying that the Buddhist view is better or that meditators might not need therapy. I'm just pointing out a contrast. The rheological paradigm views purification as the sensory circuits learning how not to interfere with themselves. The theme of reducing self-conflict, inappropriate holding, and fixation sounds familiar to a lot of what's talked about in psychotherapy. But there's a fundamental difference between the psychotherapeutic paradigm and the rheological paradigm. In the psychological model, the self-conflict, inappropriate holding, and fixation that are addressed belong to a large temporal scale, patterns that have persisted in a person's life for a week, months, years, or decades. The rheological paradigm addresses self-interference at a microscopic scale, holdings and fixations that go on continuously below the threshold of awareness at the timescale of a few seconds, or even a few hundred milliseconds. Personally, I think each of these paradigms of purification can be useful. Psychotherapy repairs areas that Buddhist meditation may not get to. Materialistic rheology and religious theology are not necessarily pointing to incompatible realities. The amphibious human. Any experience, simple or complex, pleasant or unpleasant, internal or external, bizarre or banal, can be greeted with concentration, clarity, and equanimity, or not. It would be convenient to have a word that indicates the degree to which a given sensory event is being experienced mindfully. The word I use for that is completeness. When we greet a sensory event with little mindfulness, our experience of that sensory event will not be very complete. If we experience a sensory event with a medium level of mindfulness, that experience gets closer to being complete. If we greet an experience with the fullest possible mindfulness, that experience becomes as complete as can be. Regardless of how ordinary a sensory event may be, when it is experienced with radical completeness, it becomes utterly extraordinary, indeed paradoxical. There is a deep complementarity between having complete experiences and purifying consciousness. By trying to experience each event in life as completely as possible, we purify consciousness. But the more consciousness gets purified, the easier it is to have complete experiences. When there is maximal concentration, clarity, and equanimity, an experience becomes maximally complete, and any maximally complete experience is much like any other complete experience. They all have one taste, the taste of rich vacuity combined with dynamic tranquility, which is totally paradoxical. Complete pain causes rather little suffering and doesn't turn into aversion. Complete pleasure brings lasting satisfaction and doesn't turn into neediness. A complete experience of confusion creates a basis for spiritual intuition. A complete experience of desire is desireless. A complete experience of boredom is endlessly fascinating. A sensory experience is just some tiny part of the universe, the wind touching your face, an act of making love, tying your shoes, being angry with a student. Yet when we experience any of those completely, it links us to the fullness of creation and the vacuity of the Creator. I like to think of humanity as destined to be amphibious, moving back and forth between two worlds like a frog. I imagine that a frog is happy because it's a creature of two worlds. When it is appropriate to be on dry land, it is comfortable there. When it is appropriate to be in the water, it is comfortable there. A frog can go back and forth between water and land anytime it wants, as frequently as it wants. If it gets tired of the water, it can go to dry land. And if it gets tired of dry land, it can go to the water. It enjoys unimpeded freedom of movement between these two realms. We human beings were also meant to traverse two realms. We were meant to submerge beneath the water of oneness into the world of completeness, fluidity, connectivity, and vacuity, and then to come out into the solidity, separateness, and somethingness of dry land for certain kinds of functions. The problem is we have forgotten how to get back into the water, and now we are stuck in the arid zone. Most humans have no way to refresh in the cooling waters of the source. Here's the top page summary. Ordinary experience, when greeted with concentration, clarity, and equanimity, catalyzes a process of insight and purification, which culminates in the ability to have complete experiences whenever you want. This theory is quite elegant. It has all the marks of good science. A good scientific theory has simplicity, generality, and power. Simplicity means that it is not overly complicated. Generality means that it applies to a wide range of circumstances, and power means it gives you a good handle on what is going on. The theory of meditation has all these marks. It well deserves the name Science of Enlightenment.